Well, good afternoon to everyone, and thanks for coming. It's good to see you, in spite of the beginning of them, which makes things a bit difficult sometimes. So today, for the first seminar of the Greater France Seminar Series, it's our pleasure to welcome Bertrand Tet from the University of Manchester to talk about the afterlives of colonial anti-heroes, and looking in particular at the cases of Foulet and Chanoine since 1900. So we thought it was particularly fitting for today's first seminar of the Greater France series, which is part also of research networks which are developing within the university, so namely the Franco-Poco and Postcolonial Birmingham Research Initiatives, to dedicate our first seminar to this topic of the popular representations of anti-heroes of the colonial empire, of the French colonial empire. So today what Bertrand will be talking about will be not a story of the glorious civilizing mission, but actually the inglorious French civilizing mission, on which he's published, among many other books drawn throughout his and written throughout his very long career, which is here, and which states in no less than seven pages, The Killer Trail, which was published last year at Oxford University Press, and looked at the history of one probably of the most unusual of the, or maybe the most usual, we will see what Bertrand has to say about them and about their features, but at least in French historiography, one of the most unusual French missions to the center of Africa, the mission led by the Commandants Voulet and Chanoine, which left some very bad memories in Africa, and which is still today remembered in many African countries as the epitome of the exactions of French imperialism in Africa. So without further ado, I would like to welcome once again Bertrand. Thank you for coming also together with other members of a research group on the decolonization of anti-heroes, which brings together research staff from the universities of Manchester, Lancaster, McMaster, and Birmingham on theme of imperial heroes and anti-heroes in particular. And I would like to thank Bertrand for coming, but also the members of this group to present today, Mark Jones and Peter Yeandel, to thank them for coming and also attending this paper. Bertrand, it's over to you.
Well, it's as you gather, this is a paper that was intended to be given as part of a conversation around hero and hero worship within imperial, post-colonial, colonial, post-colonial environments. So it isn't really, it's not a standalone piece. It was meant to engage in this dialogue, and unfortunately I wasn't able to attend it at a time for tragic circumstances. But I'm very glad to be in Birmingham and to be able to talk about afterlives of anti-heroes. Now, if we take as a starting point that, to paraphrase Simone de Beauvoir, one is not born a hero, but one becomes one. And that's certainly true of anti-heroes, and anti-heroes are most certainly defined post-mortem. So there is this emphasis that I'm going to put on what happened after the story has ended, at least after the death, or alleged death, of the participants. Now, to return to Carlyle's definition and of heroes, and I'm going to quote from his lecture of May the 5th, 1840, we have undertaken to discourse here for a little on great men, their manner of appearance in our world's business, how they've shaped themselves in the world history, what ideas men form of them, what work they did, on heroes namely, and on their reception and performance, what I call hero worship and the heroic in human affairs. And he continues, they were the leaders of men, these great ones, the modelers, patterns, and in a wider sense, creators of whatsoever the general mass of men contrive to do or to attain. All things that we see standing accomplished in the world are properly the outer material result, the practical realization and embodiment of thoughts that dwelt in the great men sent into the world, the soul of the world's history. It may justly be considered where the history of these. Now, the key question, of course, is what do we put anti-heroes in relation to this kind of narrative, and how do anti-heroes fit with this broader description of heroism? I think we can agree that apart from occasional Bond villains, most anti-heroes are men or women shaped in the heroic mode with no a priori intention of becoming so. Now, from this perspective, I'd like to consider the afterlives of two individuals who are they're almost so joined in their existence and indeed their death that they almost become one entity, Voulet Chanoine, and Captain Voulet and Captain Chanoine, two French officers who allegedly died in July 16 and 17, 1899, in a village not very far from a place called Zinder in what is today Niger, which was then on the edge of the French Empire, indeed the last boundary of the West African French Empire. Now, I'm going to start the paper by looking at a narrative which turned these two men, which were until then, were well on their way to becoming real heroes. You see, the interesting thing about Voulet and Chanoine is, of course, that they missed heroism, by a considerable step, but they missed heroism by not all that much. And ultimately, in the bigger picture, these two men could have become heroes. They didn't become heroes. They became anti-heroes by a re-evaluation of their action. Now, I'm going to start with these two, the sort of short narrative, and I'm going to go very quickly, and I hope you'll forgive me. And then I'm going to explore how these stories were engaged with in the contemporary debates on colonial violence. Contemporary, I mean, in the 1900s, early 1900s, to move on to fiction, especially in the work of Jules Verne and subsequent novels and films that actually exploited the story of Voulet and Chanoine, up to very recent interpretations, including Nigerian interpretations of Voulet and Chanoine, also in fiction. So I'm going to move really onto the sort of fictional afterlives of these two individuals. So let's start with their story. This is it is a part of a map. And it's a part of a map of what the French call the penetration of Africa, or rather the conquest of Chad. So a narrative, if you want, of all the great missions that went down from the north, the most famous for this particular period being, of course, the Fourreau-Lamy mission, and from the west, or indeed from the south, all of them converging on this quasi-mythical place, Lake Chad. And Lake Chad, if you think geostrategically, has a central role in the French map of Africa, because if you control Chad, you can link central African possessions to Western African possessions, and indeed, ultimately, through the desert, North African possessions. So the Voulet Chanoine mission began in Senegal and moved down in that general direction. It is this one, in fact, the one with the little dots. But what's interesting about this little map here is that it is actually never called the Mission Voulet Chanoine. It is called the Joalan Meunier mission, which of course never existed as a mission. So their name was erased from this map. This is a map from the Trans-Saharan plans of Leroy Beaulieu in that particular period. So even onto the... This is a map that was produced 5 years after the death. So 5 years after the death, they have been erased from public commemorations of the colonial adventure. This is a little map I produced, which is not tremendously actually clear from where you stand, but it gives you a sense of where they went. The limits of the French Empire, something has happened to the font, I'm sorry. The limits of the French Empire were about here. It took them something like 7 months to actually travel from here to here, where they found their death in this particular area. So this in Dankori here, in this particular village, a village on the border. So what did they do in this, few hundred miles? And why did it become a scandal? The story, interestingly, is a story of a scandal that travels from Africa to France through the medium of a number of mediations. Essentially, the original scandal is that they massacred more or less everybody that they encountered who resisted or even claimed to resist on their way. very difficult to know exactly how many people they massacred because the archives are somewhat coy as to the extent of the massacres or the nature of the massacres. But on the whole, we know that, for example, in a place called Birnin Koni, which is somewhere there, the extent of the massacre varies between 1,000 people and 10,000 out of a population estimated at 7,000 to 10,000. So either the entire population was massacred or only 1 in 10, and the rest being probably partially enslaved or dispatched. Over this period, this is a mission, this is a very heavy mission. It contains, it has probably 800 porters when it leaves. It has several hundred men, about 600 fighters, plus their families, plus their domestic servants, and probably by the time it stops in Zinda, it has probably about 800 slaves, most of whom are female slaves. And there is an economy of female slavery going on within the mission. That is, the slaves are used to pay the soldiers, to reward the officers and non-commissioning officers, and they use also as bartering currency, as a currency, exchanging female slaves against animals. And so they are actually a kind of form of it's a pillage that is organized by the mission. And interestingly, it contains an element of sexual rivalry in a sense that we know that, and I'll come back to that in a minute, we know that sexual violence is at the heart of the mission, in the sense that we know, for example, that one NCO, one non-commanding officer of African origin, and one soldier were executed for having slept with French NCOs' women, quote unquote. So there is jealousy, rivalry for the control of women within that mission. All of that was, of course, covered up later on, but that's actually in the archives, that's documented, well-established facts. Well, facts. problematic facts. So, in other words, you've got a mission which behaves badly, very badly, on extraordinary violent terms. How badly is an issue that we could discuss, probably worse than most missions in West Africa, but I would argue that most missions in West Africa prior to Vulé and Chan 1 actually did similar things, but on a smaller scale and on a smaller journey. You know, the journey is very long, it's very extensive, very slow. This is an extremely arid part of Africa. They are struggling with the traveling, so they move incredibly slowly. I mean, you know, even when they're moving at full speed, they do 2 miles an hour maximum, and sometimes they stay put for 2, 3, 4 weeks. You know, so it's a very slow-moving column that sort of grinds its way across Africa. So they behave badly, undoubtedly, but really one of the reasons the scandal explodes, and I'm come back to that, is really because we're in a slightly different context than most of the other context. So I'm going at double speed on the story, but that's the story is only the prelude of the paper, really. The scandal explodes in Paris in April 1899, and it's going to be largely a denunciation of atrocities of war. There's crimes of war that the French commit in Africa. So it is explicitly a scandal about French military presence in Africa and the type of destruction it wreaks along the way. It's a debate around the nature of colonial warfare, but it's also because we're in the middle of the Dreyfus Affair. Now, it's not insignificant to note that Captain Chanoine's father was the minister of war that tried to bring the Brisson government in the autumn 1898 because he refused to revise the Dreyfus affair. He refused to allow a retrial of Dreyfus. So we are in a particular situation in the sense that Captain Chanoine is extremely well connected to the elites of the French army. These elites are anti-Dreyfusard. We are in the final throes of the Dreyfus affair. In 1899, you've got the revision of the trial in Rennes, which will take place, you know, this famous trial of Captain Dreyfus, at the end of which the French army decided that he was guilty with attenuating circumstances, which enabled a sort of compromise liberation of Dreyfus, and then later on his rehabilitation. So the army is grudgingly admitting that it has misbehaved in relation to Dreyfus.
There's also an international context in the sense that in 1899, a number of other stories are coming across. The Germans are not behaving particularly well in Togoland. The Belgian stories are starting to come out of Leopold's private empire, and the stories aren't very nice. And of course, in 1899, you've got the publication of The Heart of Darkness, which has remained a template of Western literature on atrocities in colonial context. And interestingly, the story that comes across, if you want, is going to be that these French soldiers are losing their way in Africa, but largely because of Africa. Now, the story is, at that stage, the heroic status of Voulet and Chanoine is not entirely compromised yet, I would argue. But the French send another mission behind them, led by an army officer called Colonel Club. And Colonel Club will meet Voulet and Chanoine on July 14. So July 14, there's a bit of symbolism in the story, you couldn't make it up. On July 14, 1899, they meet in July 14, and Voulet's reaction to the arrival of his superior is to ambush him and kill him, which it becomes the scandal. And this is the interesting, so if we follow my anti-heroes, the first anti-heroic dimension is, of course, that they're shapers of atrocities rather than shapers of civilization. But really, that what will stick to them harder than anything else is this act of mutiny in the middle of Africa. The killing of Colonel Club in an ambush that's been carefully prepared. And subsequently, another mutiny, African soldiers' mutiny against Voulet and Chanoine, killed Chanoine. On the 16th of July, and they killed Voulet on the 17th. So there's the three officers die in very quick succession. The rest of the column will reorganize and become the famous Joalan Meunier makeup story. And I'll come back to Meunier in a minute. How do we explain that in that particular time? One of the explanations that's a reinvented diagnostic which existed already, but which was denoting a kind of extreme boredom, which is Sudanitis, the disease of living in Sudan. If you live in Sudan, the disease that French people will contract by the sheer fact of not being in France, and especially living in Sudan with alcohol plus sexuality, unbridled sexuality, and of course a concentration of vices. That's reinvented by the army to explain the madness of Voulet. Voulet was a hero, he lost his mind. You know, we've got to explain Voulet, and we're going to explain it by a form of a loss of his mental senses. The anti-militarists have a variant on this one, they call La Folie des Galons, which is that it is not Africa that actually makes people mad, it's the French hierarchy, it's the French military system, which emphasizes that officers are running after promotions. One of the reasons to go to West Africa in the 1890s is because promotion is extremely quick in West Africa. You either die or you get promoted quickly. And the two go together, obviously. This is the most dangerous area in West Africa by far in terms of mortality for the French. You know, it's an extremely, it's even more dangerous than going to Madagascar, which is regarded as an extremely dangerous place to do campaigns. And a lot of emphasis, interestingly, we're in the 1890s, you've got to remember the sort of cultural background of France, you know, the sort of post-Charcot environment, is going to put an emphasis on sexual and morality dysfunction, this idea that something is happening in Africa that has a fundamentally perverse effect, and that there is a perversity at the heart of the imperial project. And the architect of this particular vision of Voulet and Chanoine is a doctor, Paul Vignier Docton. In fact, his real name is Paul Vignier Docton, is the village from which he originated. Paul Vignier Docton, who had served as an army physician on the Navy, had experience of West Africa and wrote a series of, if you want, a mixture of literature. I wouldn't recommend reading his books, they're dreadful. But if, in case you're interested, Chair Noir is the first one that really sort of had an impact, and he's about a French colonist losing any kind of civilization or any semblance of a civilized deportment by being exposed to the relentless sensuality of his colonial environment. Les Amours de Nine is, incidentally, is a Provençalist kind of novel, but the one that sort of became his sort of trademark book is Le Soudan d'Ahomey, Terre de Mort. As you can see, a fairly bleak message on the colonial enterprise in West Africa. And very strongly, Vigier-Docton argues that the colonial enterprise is perverse, fundamentally sexually perverse, and that this perversity is the product of a system, a military system, and also a context, an African context, in which innocent and rather limited, not terribly well-educated French army officers lose themselves. And in a sense, he's inspired by Le Dérèglement des Sens of Rimbaud, he's inspired by Zola, and he has followed the classes of Charcot. So he's inspired by neurology, psychiatry, and physiology. So there's a whole understanding, if you want, of West Africa as being debilitating. Of course, you could argue today that these are the effects of anemia and malaria onto the body, but the idea of that it's a debilitating climate and that this debilitation of the body is also impacting on the moral fabric of the individual. So, in his book, La Gloire du Sabre of 1900, Vigier-Docton will really pillory, systematically, and by that stage he's a member of parliament, he's a deputy for Clermont-Lérault, he will pillory systematically French excesses in the colony, but he finds that his publisher withdrew the imprimatur, so he has to publish it at his own expenses, and his book is so excessive, allegedly, according to this contemporary, that people describe it as a work of fiction and related to his previous novels. The irony, of course, is that La Gloire du Sabre, as far as I can see, is primarily not a work of fiction at all. It's certainly a violent denunciation of French abuse in West Africa, but has virtually no fictional element to it, just literary elaboration on the practices. Vigier-Docton later on moved on to become one of the first popularizers of the theories of Freud in France, in the sort of left-wing popular press, quasi-trash press. So by 1900, by La Gloire du Sabre, Voulez and Chanoine have become, if you want, the epitome of evil in a colonial project. Now, how do we locate that intellectually? Now, this is a very important debate, which has been covered a while back by people like Brunswick, and which is fundamentally, is this anti-colonialism? And arguably, you could legitimately argue that people like Vigier-Docton, like Clemenceau, are not so much anti-colonialist than anti-militarist. And that really, a lot of their focus is that it is not so much in about the Imperial Project as a whole, but about the methods of the Imperial Project. And later on in life, he will publish in 1911 La Sueur du Burnou, which is still in print, by the way, a powerful denunciation of colonial exploitation in Tunisia. So he will actually take a sort of, if you want, indigenist viewpoint, but I wouldn't, you know, this is not Franz Fanon, you know, it's a rather inchoate theory based largely on the danger that the colonies present to the colonialists themselves, the sort of undermining of the French race in that particular context. So ironically, both the friends and the enemies of Voulez and Chanoine singularized them as insane. And the sort of insanity became a kind of cover-up. The inquiry that was meant to take place was never public. Even the parents of Voulez and Chanoine never got the truth about the circumstances of the death of Voulez and Chanoine. And it is an interesting point here. It is, as far as I know, the only case of mutiny in the French army that doesn't lead to an inquiry about the people who killed Voulez and Chanoine. Because, after all, their soldiers killed them. Now, you have an interesting story. You've got a mutiny within a mutiny. That second mutiny, the mutiny of the African soldiers against their officers, is completely whitewashed, disappeared. To the point that it became unclear whether they had ever died. And you've got to put in a sort of, if Voulez and Chanoine are the dark side of this legend, there is a gilded side of the legend that appears simultaneously, which is part of the cover-up, which is, of course, that of Commandant Lamy and the great conqueror of Chad. And Commandant Lamy, who dies, actually doesn't die at all like this, because he's not on, I don't think he's on a horse when he gets shot, but and suddenly he's attacking a Tata, so that very much they'd be on a horse to attack a city. But Commandant Lamy, who was a quasi-saint, saint officer, humble man, religious man, not quite Père de Foucault, but near enough. So as Voulet and Chanoine are actually diabolized or made clinically insane in the story, other counter-myths are created for the purpose of reinvigorating the conquest of Chad, which will carry on without Voulet and Chanoine. So we have, in other words, anti-heroes producing heroes and kind of symbiotic. We need, you know, there's a gap, we'll fill that gap. Incidentally, Voulet and Chanoine are not insignificant characters. You know, Voulet has conquered the Mossé region, Ouagadougou, what is now the essential. Voulet and Chanoine together, more or less, were the first conquerors of what is today Burkina Faso. So they almost conquered an entire territory at a cost of 50,000 francs, so on the cheap. They were well on their way to heroics in the colonial pantheon at that stage. Now, what's interesting about this story is, of course, that Voulet and Chanoine disappear almost entirely. And when Albert Londres, later, visited in the 1920s, visited the region, he says, going across the cities, the colonial cities of West Africa, I read the street names, Gallieni Street, Archinard Street, Binger Street. Here is the street of Lieutenant Boiteux. This lieutenant entered Timbuktu before Bonnier and Joffre. He was massacred. So was Bonnier. Bonnier Street. Voulet and Chanoine gave France the Mossé. With 50 men, they sent off the 3,000 cavalrymen of the Moro Naba, which is not true, by the way. They took Ouagadougou. On learning this and probably a few other small things, the government sent them Lieutenant Colonel Club to take their place. They killed him. No Voulet Chanoine Street. He then adds a reference to the legend of Chanoine. He says, Chanoine, it is said, is still roaming the outer reaches of the Sahel, dressed as a Tuareg, or past. Now, that mythology is the important part of the story, because Voulet probably died, probably, and Chanoine probably died too, but for two dead bodies, about whom there is no actual inquiry as to the mutiny that might have killed them, which would have forced the French army to execute some of the African NCOs who would have killed those two French soldiers. You don't kill your officers, even if they're mad, with impunity. You know, there's a kind of law in French army that you don't do that sort of thing. You might arrest them, but you don't execute them. And the graves, of course, were very much in situ. And there are two graves, which originally weren't located anywhere near each other. And the graves of, Voulet and Chanoine moved a fair bit in their post-existence, because in 1904, their graves were dug up and united. But, of course, only one grave contained a body. And that presents a problem. And in a sense, we have two graves, which date from 1899. One grave is opened, and the grave of Chanoine contains nothing at all. And there are two explanations which are given simultaneously, but with slight incoherence. The first one is that the women of the 800 women of this phenomenal caravan took revenge on the body of Chanoine and tore it to pieces. That's one hypothesis. And the other hypothesis is that dogs did the job, and that only a few remnants were left over of Chanoine, which were then put into the grave. The acidic ground did the rest and removed the flesh. The graves are today in a village in Niger. I'll come back to them because they are, of course, a touristic site. Now I need to keep an eye on my clock. So we have, if you want, a first story, and the story that sort of sticks is that Voulet or Chanoine, or possibly both, were actually still alive. This idea that there might have been some kind of agreement and that those officers might have drifted into Tuareg territory. I don't see why the Tuaregs would have particularly welcomed those psychopathic characters, especially because they had actually fought the Tuaregs immediately before. But this story is going to be picked up in two novels that I'm going to spend a little bit more time detailing to you, because they're sort of revealing. The first one is Jules Verne, the last novel ever written by Jules Verne, which is L'étonnante aventure de la mission Barsac, which has recently been reissued, which was published by Sand Michel, and you know that Michel Verne, to a large extent, picked up the last manuscript of his father and reinvented them, so rewrote them quite considerably, to the extent that it's very difficult to distinguish which is what, what belongs to Michel and what belongs to Jules. And another novel by Franz Toussaint, which I'll come back to in just a minute. Now, the Jules Verne story is an interesting reinvention because it's based around a mythical place called Blackland. And Blackland is, as you would expect, a high-tech city lost in the desert, a site of unrestrained lust and violence. And the novel is organized in a very interesting and puzzling way. It begins with a debate on colonial citizenship. That is, La Mission Barsac is a parliamentary mission that is going into Africa to decide whether Africans should be granted a vote. That's the beginning of the story. It is not only, and on that mission, you've got two characters who are ciphers for the left and the right, and those two characters are meant to be comedic, if you want. You've got the ultra-indigenist, and you've got the anti-indigenist, that is, the assimilationist on the one hand, and on the other, of course, the separate development theorist of the colonial empire. So there is a fairly astute critic of the polarities of French imperialism in that particular period. It puts the entirety of the modernity into the desert, this idea that there is this kind of black land dominated by an evil Englishman, the real anti-hero in this case is not a French officer who might have lost his way, but his kind of evil counterpart, Harry Killer. And Harry Killer is, of course, the epitome of evil, living in Blackland. And Blackland has kind of aeroplanes that help you kidnap and terrorize the West and possibly the world, of course. You won't be surprised to know that at the end, it's a rather convoluted plot, so I'll spare you the detail. But at the end, the whole thing explodes, and Blackland gets swamped by the desert again, just as the French Meharis arrive. Particularly high-tech equipment to rescue the Mission Barsac. The idea here is to concentrate this idea of rebellion and violence and associate it with modernity. And the interesting thing, this is the interesting story about the myth that follow Voulet and Chanoine, which pick up from Voulet and Chanoine often explicitly, is that there is a relationship to modernity. There's a characterized link. Interestingly, you find that even in British literature, Voulet and Chanoine makes a brief appearance in the sense that Beaugeste has actually a whole section set in a rebellion, in a kind of mutiny that takes place in a fort near Zinder, where Voulet and Chanoine themselves died, and the references are fairly explicit. So we have a set of literary figures, but which is picked up in storytelling and myth in the colonies. It's quite interesting that within West Africa, the story of Voulet and Chanoine having survived is perpetuated by the French, but also by the natives. And this is a very interesting aspect of the story. And it's picked up in a novel called Moi le Mort, which is published in the 1930. And the story of Moi le Mort is not that dissimilar from Blackland in the sense that it associates high technology and the desert. But in this novel, a mysterious inscription makes it back to Paris. It's a piece of parchment with an inscription on it in the language of the Tuaregs. And it refers to the death of a French officer called Gertal. And Gertal has been abandoned and, in fact, betrayed and left as dead by his best friend, Bren, who turns out to be a psychotic serial killer. And the fiancé of Gata will endeavour to go across the desert in aeroplanes to identify and find Gertal. And she eventually does find him, after a few crashes and a number of murders. She finds him, and interestingly, the point of this is that Gertal has turned into a monster. So Gertal is very much the same character, the same fundamental character as Kurtz in The Heart of Darkness. He has turned into this ruler of a mini-empire in the middle of Africa, where he commits a number of atrocities, and Gertal, at the end, in a kind of manic frenzy, tramples the French flag in a scene that's quite ridiculous. And just before coming back to his senses and killing Bren, and after killing Bren, somehow he gets his senses back and becomes again a hero, interestingly. All the atrocities he's committed against the Africans have been wiped out. He embraces the lady, and that's the end of the book. Now, Franz Toussaint is interesting because he's an Orientalist, a scriptwriter. He has written a number of films. He was born in 1879 from a military family, and he did his military service in Sudan in 1900, exactly a year after the Voulet-Chanoine affair. He has a very deep connection to the Sudanese story. He picks it up, and everybody in 1930 recognizes Moi le Mort as a fictional account of, if you want, a departure from the Voulet-Chanoine affair. So there is a very interesting triangulation going on here, which frames it in a colonial imaginary, which, far from being silent, endlessly repeats the events of 1899. And you find that this link is interesting because, of course, there is a displacement. The Voulet-Chanoine is displaced towards the Sahara, and I think this is not an insignificant point. The Voulet-Chanoine becomes a full desert story, and that links, I think, well, obviously to the work that Ben has done, but it links to this idea of the Atlantic, the concept that was developed in the novel of Pierre Bonnoir, filmed in a silent movie in 1921, and of course picked up again in 1932. So the idea of the Atlantic, this is the place where civilization sinks, the sinking place of civilization, which of course goes against the Sahara as the revealer or the place where great heroes are made, which of course is the counterpoint. But there is a counterpointal structuring of the narrative of heroism in the French Empire that comes across. Now, ever since 1930, for a story that went completely, that is silence. It's a story that never ceases to be commented and published about. All the survivors of the Voulet-Chanoine story will publish about it. And all of them saying, I can no longer keep silent, this is weighing too heavily. And Jean Allan published his, allegedly his youth memoir in 1930, in answer to a number of publications, especially around the death of or non-death of Voulet and Chanoine, trying to basically say, yes, they are dead, and this is the way they died, and we've got to forget these people, we've got to avoid reminiscing about them. But we also have another one, whom I haven't mentioned here on my list, actually, with Olivier Meunier. And now, Octave Meunier. And Octave Meunier is a very interesting character, because Octave Meunier is a survivor of the Club mission, so he has not committed atrocities. Of his own, not at least that I could find. But Octave Meunier will carry on the mission of Voulet and Chanoine, become a kind of hero in his own right. He will lose an arm during the First World War. He will be the inventor, if you want, of the first races across the Sahara, like motor races, bringing cars from Algeria all the way to the Niger River. Make the first, if you want, Paris-Dakar kind of events are organized by Octave Meunier, and Octave Meunier is a kind of archetypal imperialist, and he comes back several times to the story of Voulet and Chanoine, every time more dismissive of Voulet and Chanoine. In 1945, famously described Voulet and Chanoine as quasi-Germans. You know, how do you explain Voulet and Chanoine? Well, it's quite simple. You know, German ideas were dominant in 1899, you know, so Nietzsche and all that, and they succumbed, you know. So it's no longer Sudanitists that drove them mad, it's their philosophical readings. Now, I don't want to go through the whole detail of this, but fundamentally, it's worth saying that the story of Voulet and Chanoine recurs, and this recurrence is fictionalized to a large extent. It's fictionalized throughout, and it's fictionalized not only in the West, it's fictionalized in Africa as well. So, to mention the African perspective, there are several things that come to mind. The first one is that the myth of Voulet being alive comes across from interviews that were undertaken in the 1920s and 1930s by the white fathers in the Gurun Sea and in the Ouagadougou region of Burkina Faso. And every time they interviewed, to the great surprise, the survivors of the Wole Shannon mission said, no, not dead. No, never died. They're absolutely not dead. Then the story is slightly reinvented, and you find that Wole became a kind of, if not a hero, but certainly a character of some power, and his nickname in one of the local languages of the Songhai is Zahanan, which means man of iron, a man of steel. So Wole becomes a kind of archetypal imperialist in the local memory. The sheer mention of the name Wole actually served as a way of repressing any kind of resistance to the French for at least 10 years after the event. So the idea that Wole might come back was actually explicitly used by the French administrators, namely, for example, William Ponty, but a number of others were actually found him reasonably useful as a kind of potential bogeyman of colonialism. Jean Rouch, who is the famous filmmaker and anthropologist, has turned with Paul and his successor, his quasi-son, as he calls himself, Paul Stoller, have actually turned around the story of Wole and Shanwan, and there seems to have been a continued presence of Wole and Shanwan. The refusal that Wole and Shanwan had ever died seems to have been haunting to an extent in that region, and might have contributed, in at least their interpretation, to the Hoka cult, which displaced itself from this particular region to Ghana. I'm keeping an eye on my... How am I doing?
Oh, that's fine.
Am I right? Yes. I won't be very long. In the French historiography, one of the most complete history of the mission, but which basically takes exactly the same lines as the official story, is Muriel Mathieu, La Mission Afrique Centrale. And more recently, in France, the debate has become more entangled into a devoir de repentance. You know, I don't know if the phrase is familiar to you. I assume it is, but this notion that we have to integrate Wole and Shanwan into the great colonial story. And of course, you know that in France, the colonial debate has been revived by the rather clumsy political intervention of the right wing government and the attempt to actually teach in schools the benefit, les effets bénéfiques de la colonisation, which obviously aren't obvious to everybody. And the counter attack on this was led by people like Le Cours Grand Maison, which has recently been... The whole debate is actually, if you're interested in that, there's a very good article by Stephen Ho last summer, which is very good, which covers pretty well the Le Cours Grand Maison debate, which shows very well how the whole debate was framed in French politics. I can give you the reference. But Le Cours Grand Maison wrote his famous book Colonisé, Exterminé, which is an absolutely... incendiary denunciation of the French colonization of Algeria, mostly, but which applies to every other colonies that the French ever went into, obviously, which accuses the French state of systematic genocidal intent, or at least of some genocidal intent with systematic achievement of some of these intents. I mean, it's only, I don't know if I'm doing justice to that book, but it certainly does some of that. Now, Wole and Shanwan, interestingly, although it's a complete... from a military point of view, it's not a particularly successful nor even very long-lasting campaign. Inspired, from the Nigerian point of view, counter-narratives, and especially in the sense of the story of the Sahraounia, and Sahraounia being the one instance of a female African leader resisting the French. And not quite successfully, in the sense that a village was destroyed, but not unsuccessfully either, in the sense that she was never caught, and that Wole and Shanwan was suddenly stopped along his way. So Sahraounia in Niger has become a kind of folk heroine. She's been somewhat sexualized in the novel by Mamani, who makes her a young woman, when in fact she was probably an older woman. The Sahraounia belonged to a dynasty or series of female rulers of this particular village of Lugu. Lugu is now on the list of the potential sites for the UNESCO listing. So there is a whole, if you want, Nigerian mythology built in response or retaliation to Wole Shanwan himself. And interestingly, Wole and Shanwan have become part of the tourist map of Niger. And there is this kind of reinvention, once again, of the colonial enterprise, the anti-heroes are actually turning into attractive characters, and especially their graves. Now, these graves, which are partially invented, as we found out, because at least one of them is empty, have attracted a lot of visitors. And I'm a quote here from an oral history that was led by a man called Jean-Luc Cohen, who went to Maillirgui, the place where both Voulet and Chanoine are buried, and interviewed with his translator, a very fairly innocent chap, but interesting name, and went to interview the local village elders. And the village elders all sat down around the tombs of Voulet and Chanoine and told him this is the way Voulet and Chanoine died. And basically say, well, actually, Chanoine was shot by Voulet. And that's a great surprise, because, of course, that's a version of the event that nobody's told before. Mm. Voulet shot Chanoine over a woman that Voulet had taken, that Chanoine had taken and that Voulet coveted. Now, what's interesting about this anecdote, which, of course, they will tell every tourist for a fee, is that, of course, it sort of mixes a number of narratives. It mixes the killing of Clob with the killing, the death of Chanoine and Voulet, but it also mixes, more interestingly, the whole notion that sexuality and sexual violence was at the heart of this enterprise, and that somehow this memory of this violence to women has become an absolutely central trope of the afterlives of Voulet and Chanoine. Right, so where does it take us? Well, this is the subject. I'm quite fully-fledged, completely. I think it begs a lot of questions about what is the role of the anti-hero in the narrative, that in the sort of dialogic of the colonial self-mythologizing. Because the interesting thing about the Voulet-Chanoine story is that it's very, they die in 1899, they're wiped out from existence by 1905, they reappear by 1910, by 1920, by 1930, And at the same time, the French colonial empire is memorializing itself very, very early on. You find that, for example, Zinder is renamed Fort Casemajou. Casemajou dies in 1898. In 1900, he's got a fort named after him. Lamy dies in 1901. And the Fort Lamy is created the same year. So you've got a commemorative effect in the French Empire, which is very, very, very sudden, very quick. In 1930, we gather all the elders of the empire, and Octave Meunier turns up in his cavalcade to the Niger River. There's already a sort of triumphalist, but interestingly, the historicization is going at such a pace that you do wonder what role anti-heroes play in that. Do you need anti-heroes to actually function a kind of historical narrative on double speed? I wonder. I mean, that Voulet Chanoine are symptomatic of the immorality of the colonial enterprise, hardly a novel concept. That perhaps there is something quite banal about them, that they actually, the banality of their evil is certainly something that appeals on the one hand, although ultimately there is always a return to the exceptionality of the story, or indeed the insanity narrative. And in this sense, the film by Serge Moati from France Télévisions, and the documentary that accompanied it, which was Manuel Gasquet Blanc de Mémoire in 2006, picked up again the myth of the insanity of the colonial enterprise, the insanity of Voulet and Chanoine, as if by trying to remind the French of what they did in the French colonial empire, they somewhat had to plunge back into a narrative which is fundamentally a narrative of oblivion and loss. So thank you very much.